Weighing Machine was created to help you, the financial advisor or investor, reach your long-term financial goals. Each episode, your hosts, Rusty Vanneman and I, Robin Murray, cut through the market glamour to find the time-tested principles that help investors succeed.
The Weighing Machine is inspired by the classic investing saying attributed to Benjamin Graham. The stock market is a voting machine in the short term and a weighing machine over the long run. In other words, emotion and expectations drive short-term market movement, but fundamentals and valuations determine returns over time.
Welcome to The Weighing Machine.
Enjoy, and as always, let us know what you think.
On the podcast today, rate hikes, inflation, and the investment benefits of lobbying.
We will also take a deep dive into the impact of lobbying on your bottom line. Plus, how can we encourage more women to join the investment industry? That's with our guest, Courtney Rosenberger, Managing Director of Policy Research and Strategus Securities. Welcome to The Weighing Machine. I'm Rusty Vanneman.
And I'm Robin Murray. Okay, let's start with a look at the markets. It's been a rough first quarter so far. What are you watching for at the moment?
Well, it's definitely been a tough quarter so far. And, you know, it's really even impacted the one-year returns. I was looking at this today and, you know, most parts of the U.S. stock market are even down over the last year. Value stocks are up, but it's been a pretty tough year now, even for the markets. Some asset classes, such as commodities, due to inflation concerns, have done pretty well. In fact, I was just looking at it coming in today. We are recording this in the middle of March. Is that commodities now, depending on the benchmark you look at, even have a better three-year return than the U.S. stock market. It's pretty amazing.
All right. Well, by the time this airs, the Federal Reserve will likely have introduced its first interest rate hike in this new inflationary environment. February CPI was 7.9%, I believe, and March could be closer to 9% by some estimates. What do you think of the Fed's predicted moves this year, and how is that going to impact the markets?
Well, now that you said that there will be a rate hike, and we're doing this like the day before the announcement, it means there probably won't be a rate hike. No, I think at this point, the market is expecting a quarter point. So I think it's been pretty much priced in, but we'll just see. The market is expecting a whole bunch of rate hikes over the course of the year. Of course, as always, it's data dependent. And usually what happens is not what has been forecasted. So yeah, it's obviously, there's a lot of things going on in the world right now in terms of fiscal and monetary policy, and what's happening in Washington, D.C. is critical to what is how it's impacting market direction. And we have an excellent guest to talk about such things today.
That's right. Well, let's bring her in. Courtney Rosenberger is Managing Director of Policy Research at Strategus Securities in New York. Courtney, welcome to The Weighing Machine.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Well, Courtney, kind of initiation right to be on The Weighing Machine is you have to have a walk-up song. What is the song we can hear in the background?
So I underestimated how stressful this was going to be to come up with a single song. I think it was on my mind all weekend, but I did finally come to a decision. I think I annoyed all of my family members in the process, but I'm going to go with one of my favorite groups actually in high school that mercifully has evolved out of the angry teenage music stage, Panic at the Disco's High Hopes. It's just an optimistic song. I think we could all use some optimism looking at the market and things going on in the economy these days.
I like it. Do you know, it is kind of fun. This question is the one that I think people spend the most time, because basically all our questions are right in your wheelhouse. I mean, you can answer everything in your sleep. But if you haven't considered this, yeah, I think it's the fun question.
Well, Courtney, you studied business, finance, and economics at the University of Kentucky, and then you joined Strategus in New York shortly after graduating, as far as I can tell. Can you tell us about your career there and what drew you to the investing profession?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. I joined Strategus, then called Strategus Research Partners, in May of 2014. I started right after college. I graduated, threw my stuff at my parents' house, and moved to DC 2 weeks later. And what drew me into this job, you know, for a 21-year-old, it was a dream job. It still is a dream job. But in my interview, my boss and my current boss, Dan Clifton, who is Strategus's head of policy research, basically told me, you can research anything that you want, as long as it's related somewhat to policy and you can draw a market investment conclusion from that, you can work on that. And I think that it's really hard for any 21-year-old to turn that down. I mean, anything is an option because you can connect government and investing to any issue across sectors and industries. So that's really what led me into at least working at Strategus.
That's great. So you are the lead analyst on a very unique fund called Strategus Policy Opportunities Portfolio, and the fund utilizes the firm's proprietary lobbying intensity formula. Can you tell us more about what that means and what the fund mandate is?
Yeah, so the basis for the strategy is really our belief that companies have the potential to generate alpha from their lobbying activities. So we want to hold companies that are actively and aggressively engaging in lobbying and engaging with policymakers. So the strategy is 50 large cap companies, primarily just based in the US because of our universe, that have the highest lobbying intensity according to our formula. And I would define lobbying intensity as looking at companies' lobbying expenditures, but controlling for size. So a question that we get asked a lot is, why wouldn't you just want the companies that are spending the most money? You know, why aren't you just doing this out of aggregate lobbying dollars? And when Dan Clifton, who created the strategy and is the portfolio manager on it, was first playing around with the idea of utilizing lobbying data back in 2008, 2009, he found that there really wasn't a benefit from doing that because you just end up with the top, you know, 50 companies in the S&P 500 or whatever index you're utilizing. And so what we wanted to do is control for size because you may have a company that's spending slightly less, but they're significantly smaller. So they're putting more stock in their lobbying activities. They think that there's more of a benefit for that. And that's what we wanted to target. What I think makes the strategy unique is lobbying is not a variable that you typically see. I don't think that there's many financial models that use lobbying as an input. But I quickly learned, you know, in my baptism by fire into this industry, that government has a pretty wide net that it can cast. And there really aren't any sectors or industries that are safe. And lobbying obviously is not just about trying to make sure that the government doesn't have a negative impact on your business. It's also about trying to position yourself for a potential positive benefit. So like a huge fiscal spending bill, making sure that your company is well positioned, you know, looking at the federal budget, making sure that you're seeing spending rise in areas that you want to see spending rise in. And using lobbying also has another advantage when you're looking at it from a portfolio management standpoint, and that a lot of thematic portfolios, particularly as they relate to policy outcomes, they almost have to have a short duration. There's a limited shelf life on the market impact of a single piece of legislation or an election, especially I would say an election, because you know there's a new one every 2 years and a party in power changes. And so you have a limited shelf life. You also have to time it because as we've seen in the last couple of months, you have no idea when legislation is actually going to pass or if it's going to pass. So by utilizing lobbying, which is this constant factor, we're able to have exposure to a number of different issues in Washington, and we can adjust as those issues change. So as one issue stops being prevalent, we adjust into a new issue. And as more companies, or as a company's issue may resolve, that company can fall out of the strategy and a new company come in. So I think that that's really a value that we have in the strategy.
This is a really cool investment strategy. And, you know, we really believe in diversification, of course, but most people think of diversification in terms of asset class or regional exposures or whatever, but it really need to diversify by kind of investment styles, investment philosophies. And this is definitely unique. So that's really cool. All right. So a big question is, like, in this current market environment, how is the fund positioned? What are some of the dominant themes being expressed in the portfolio right now?
Yeah, so looking at us from maybe more of a marketing positioning standpoint, our determinant is lobbying intensity. So, you know, we're entirely formula driven. So we go where the lobbying data brings us to. That said, I think we've been relatively well positioned in the current market environment. So we almost have a barbell weighting right now. Our two largest weights, outright and overweight positions, are healthcare and industrials. There's been a lot of lobbying and political activity in healthcare recently, going from the drug pricing debates in Washington with Build Back Better to ACA premium tax credits that were part of the COVID relief packages, and, you know, critical supply chain issues as well, just in the current environment. So there's been a significant lobbying force from the healthcare sector, particularly drug makers. And then with industrials, you know, our positioning is quite overweight aerospace and defense. Defense companies are just constant lobbyists because they are very reliant on the government budget. So they're consistently lobbying for more defense spending. And then I would say our third largest weight is tech. We are underweight tech relative to the S&P 500. But, you know, we're overweight semiconductors, and there's a pretty significant piece of legislation for the semiconductor industry that the industry is trying to get moved and passed in Congress right now.
Yeah.
I think what's really interesting, though, in the strategy is that a lot of these policy themes, they transcend sectors or sub-industries. So every quarter, I go through not just how much money each company is spending on lobbying, but what specific issues that they're lobbying on. So just to get an idea of, you know, is there a shift in the overall S&P 500's lobbying activities? And I think you could probably guess what the top issues were for 2021. Tax was a big one. So over 57% of the S&P 500 was lobbying on some type of a tax issue. COVID-19 was still there. Build Back Better had almost half of the companies, trade, and then the infrastructure bill as well. And the policy opportunities portfolio is overweight all of those issues. And it makes sense because every single one of those issues has the potential to be a significant benefit or a significant cost to the company, depending on, you know, how they're positioned. And because our conversation is, you know, we're recording this in March, but I believe we're being released around tax day, I want to pick on tax as a specific theme in the strategy. Because so 57% of S&P 500 companies are lobbying on tax issues, and policy opportunities portfolio, 70% of the strategy is lobbying on a tax issue. And companies were extremely active, and I would argue quite successful in their lobbying efforts against tax increases over the last year. So if you took the Biden administration's initial tax plan for calendar year 2022, it would have resulted in a $160 billion hit to corporate earnings. So S&P 500 earnings growth would have gone down by 9%. That plan was watered down, and the House had their initial plan, which was released in September. And instead of a $160 billion impact, it was a $95 billion impact. So we went from a 9% hit to earnings growth to a 5% hit to earnings growth. And then in October, we got an even greater reduction, where the proposed corporate tax increases were essentially removed. They were replaced with a minimum tax, and the international tax measures were delayed until 2023. When we do the math, we see companies saving themselves $134 billion in 2022. And that's just looking at corporate tax. If we add in pharma, which was another huge pay for when you look at Build Back Better, and there was really aggressive lobbying from the pharmaceutical industry, and you look at the full Build Back Better bill, we went from a cut in pay fors of $1.9 trillion over 9 years to $876 billion.
Wow.
Basically, corporate tax and pharma cuts were cut more than half. And I think that that's just really important to look at, you know, the success that lobbying can have and the impact that it can have on corporate earnings and, you know, how these companies can function in the future.
Well, the mandate sounds like it has a lot of flexibility, but over time, are there like structural tilts that sort of show up? Does it tend to be large cap or small cap or value or growth, or is it just truly flexible? You can't even corner it like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So we use the S&P 500 as our universe. So we're always going to be large cap, primarily US companies in the strategy. But there's certain sectors that I would say are more responsive to policy action in Washington. I think healthcare is a really good example of that. You really see healthcare lobbying ramp up once they see a threat. So there was a lot of increase in lobbying around the Affordable Care Act. Going into the 2016 election, there was a huge increase in lobbying, particularly drug makers. I'm not sure if everyone remembers candidate Hillary Clinton's tweet about insulin prices. There was a huge increase because there was a lot of fear that she was going to become president and then there was going to be, you know, an effort to do drug pricing. And that came down after President Trump won. And then when it was pretty clear that drug companies were kind of the scapegoats of everyone in Washington, we've seen lobbying for the drug makers and healthcare sector kind of increase. And it certainly increased in 2021, particularly with the drug pricing debate. Healthcare and drug companies are quite effective lobbyists, and they're, I would say, the most responsive that we see.
So in terms of the strategy, can you characterize a sort of market environment that is good for the strategy or an environment that's it probably won't perform as well?
Yeah, so I think, you know, looking at just purely our current weightings, I mean, we're positioned well for a defensive cycle. So because we are so overweight, healthcare is our largest weight right now. So I mean, the current environment is good for us, but then we also have the aerospace and defense weighting. I mean, it's unfortunate in the current climate, but the current climate is a really good performance-wise market for us. I would say, though, the way that we like to talk to clients about the strategy is, you know, there is so much volatility in Washington, and people really like to invest around political themes. But when you're talking about, you know, the current environment where in 7 of the last 8 elections, there's been a change in party in power, and you can go from talking about tax increases and tax cuts in 2017 to tax increases in 2020 and 2021, it's really hard to position yourself for that. So we think lobbying kind of gives a natural benefit and an easy one-size-fits-all solution to really levering yourself up to the policy environment without having to constantly go in and out of different types of strategies on policy and thematic portfolios.
Now, you recently wrote an article for Strategus titled Lobbying as an Investment Tool. And in it, you wrote that heightened political volatility has created uncertainty for companies. For example, Congress may cut taxes one year and raise them the next. So you argue that lobbying is an underpriced variable for corporate earnings. It's all pretty interesting. Can you tell us more about the article, which again, we'll have in the show notes, by the way?
Yeah, and I think the article is important because we've kind of just jumped into lobbying. And for people who don't have a background in it, it can be a lot. So the article tries to explain a little bit more in depth of what lobbying is and why it's important. Maybe I'll just give the cliff notes of that, because I think a lot of people have this perception that lobbying is done in this smoke-filled back room and it's just this shady activity. But 75% of S&P 500 companies lobbying. They spend $900 million in 2021. If you look at lobbying spend in total for 2021, it was $3.7 billion. So it's large cap companies, it's small cap companies, it's foreign companies, it's non-corporate entities. It's a thing that a lot of companies feel that they need to do, and they see a return on investment from that lobbying. They see a future benefit that's going to come from the investment in the lobbyist who's going to go talk to policymakers. Maybe just a few examples. A drug company, they might hire a lobbyist to talk about a drug that's not coming out for months, maybe years, because they're trying to set the groundwork for potentially a really expensive drug. And they want to build support with interest groups. They want to build support with policymakers so that they don't become a scapegoat when that drug price is released. Some companies may lobby because they're trying to disadvantage competitors. We see that a lot right now, actually, in antitrust. It's really interesting because I think people think every tech company would be lobbying against antitrust. Every communications sector company would be lobbying against antitrust. But some of these companies are lobbying for the regulation because they think that it would disadvantage a competitor more than themselves. We saw that with tobacco companies, where they were lobbying actually in favor of advertising regulations because they thought that advertising regulations on nicotine would just basically make sure that no new competitors could come in and they would have market share there. So lobbying is something that companies across the board, across sectors and industries are engaging in because they think that there's a benefit there and there's data to back this up. So one of the studies that we like to point to was by James Besson from Boston University School of Law. And he wrote a paper in 2016 that basically looked at different factors' contributions to profits. And he found that R&D and capital investments were significant contributing factors really during the 1990s. But since 2000, government regulation and lobbying and rent-seeking activities were really a driving factor of profits. So I think that that's something to really point out, that the data backs this up. This isn't just necessarily us, you know, singing our book and saying, you know, everyone should look at lobbying. And we've done a few studies as well, just looking at S&P 500 companies, 10Ks. And we found that in 2018, 52% of S&P 500 companies cited government policy as their top risk. And that's up from 26% in 2008. So there's a lot of concern from companies about the impact that, you know, government is going to have on their ability to do business going forward and their ability to position themselves against their competitors.
Interesting. Well, Courtney, switching gears a little bit here, this is something that we do ask most of our women guests that we have here, because as we all know, we are still kind of working in a male-dominated industry. Despite the fact that there are many studies that have shown that women are better investors, better financial advisors, and women will control the bulk of investable assets in the U.S. in the very near future. So as a woman investment professional, can you talk about the challenges that women face working in the industry?
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges. I mean, it's a hard question because there's so many challenges that I wasn't really anticipating when I was in college going into the industry. It can be really jarring to walk into a meeting as a sell-side analyst and there's only men at the table. It's not something that you really would expect. I think that the good news is that we're moving in the right direction, certainly not as fast as I think many of us women would like in the industry. But I think that the combination of both societal changes and perceptions, as well as the industry really realizing the value that women can bring to strategies, I think we're really moving in the right direction. I know a lot of great women who are rising up in their companies and they're, you know, game changers for the industry. And I'm really optimistic about the future. But, you know, when I was thinking about this question and I was looking at some of the data of women in finance, there's a lot of questions that I still have. And I think that we need to do a lot more work on the data analyzing and really getting a better idea of why women aren't going into the industry. Because some of the thing that was shocking to me is you look at some of these studies and they show that they break down women versus men going into finance. And at the entry level, it's pretty evenly split, 50-50. And then it, you know, quickly there is a large disparity that grows in seniority where men are outnumbering women at a very rapid pace. And the articles all give pretty similar explanation of the reason for this being, you know, the fact that women are still the primary caregivers, that women in finance tend to have working husbands more often, which makes them have to be the primary caregivers, you know, the lack of women mentors. And I would 100% agree with all those. My sister has 3 kids, 3 and under, and she works in the industry, and I have no idea how she does her job. And watching her makes me terrified for my future with balancing those. But something that I don't understand when I'm looking at that data is how we're even split at the entry level. Because I look at my finance and the econ undergrad classes, and they were 75% male, 25% female. And that might not be representative of every undergrad class by any means. But when I look at some of the data on undergrads and finance and econ and MBAs, they are predominantly men, majority men. So I have a lot of questions about why women are willing to go into finance at the entry level as an industry, but we're not attracting them at the college level. You know, is that something in how we're teaching finance? Is that something in how finance majors are marketed? Is it because we don't have enough female finance professors? And does that have any impact on why women aren't staying in the industry? You know, is coming in from a different degree, a liberal arts degree, making a difference in women's ability or want or desire to stay in the industry? And I just wish I had so much more data on, you know, who these women are that are leaving the industry or why they or, you know, what characteristics and demographics are behind who the women are who rise up in the ranks, who the women are who leave the industry, and who even just doesn't go into finance because maybe they were interested in it, but there was something that dissuaded them from going into the industry. And I wish we had better data, but I am optimistic about the future. I think it's just going to take a lot longer than we would like to get more women here.
Well, that kind of leads into the next question that I wanted to ask you. Maybe the first step to answering this is that we need more data, but from your experience and, you know, just, I guess, anecdotally, how do you think we can encourage more women to pursue investing careers and make it a more women-friendly environment where they can succeed? Well, what do you feel would, you know, would have helped you or would help you in your career?
I had the benefit of having a father that was in finance. And, you know, that's not something that we can provide to everyone, certainly by any means. But I'm not sure if I would have been interested or encouraged to go into finance if it weren't for seeing, you know, my dad go to work every day and seeing what he was doing. And then I also had a sister who went into the industry and I got to see her succeed as well. She's 5 years older than me, so she was working by the time that I went into college. And so, I mean, that's a benefit that, you know, a lot of young women aren't going to be able to have. But it wasn't talked about very much for me in high school. Finance wasn't a career that was taught. I mean, we had economics, one economics class, but there really wasn't any personal finance or any education along those lines. And I think that if that was taught, we would probably be able to get more young women interested in the career. I think at a college level, just the lack of female professors. And that's, again, that's not something that we can fix overnight. That's going to take time. But I had a handful of female professors over 4 years in finance and economics. And I think, you know, seeing people who are in the industry is really important to encouraging more women to go into it. And maybe just a last point is I think that the way that we teach finance to an extent isn't realistic of the industry. You know, when I think of my finance classes, it was a lot of modeling, particularly modeling by hand, which is very not realistic of the industry, but, you know, it was a lot of math and modeling, and there really wasn't any qualitative aspect to my classes. And there really wasn't a lot of interpreting news and policy. Policy never showed up in my classes. That's all I do now. But there wasn't any recognition that there's these outside factors beyond the balance sheet and the financial statements. And I think that if we were to talk about finance more in terms of the decision-making processes and, you know, the fact that this isn't just a purely mathematical grinding every day, punching numbers into a keyboard, you would attract a lot more people, not just women. I think you would get a lot more people with different interests and different skill sets. And I think that that's something that should be done as well.
Right on. I totally agree with you on that. I mean, just think about not only the college courses, but even like CFA materials. It's just heavy, heavy quant stuff. And the reality of it is, even for many investment managers and research analysts, there's such a qualitative aspect to it. So you're absolutely right. All right. So another question I have is, so obviously Strategus is considered one of the top research firms in the industry, and you are surrounded by a bunch of high quality investment professionals. What do you think is sort of the common thread? What makes a good research analyst and what makes a good portfolio manager?
I'll take the research analyst first. I think with research analysts, the best thing that you can be is curious. We have the privilege and maybe the curse of working in an industry where variables and factors are changing, if not every day, it seems like every minute or every hour. And you have to constantly be able to look into and investigate what's changing, how is your model affected, how is your perception of an issue affected by that. And if you're not curious, if you only want to do something once, I don't think that that makes a very good research analyst. You have to be constantly digging and trying to find a new angle on an issue. For an investment manager, maybe putting my sell-side analyst hat on, when I walk into a research meeting, I think the question that makes me know that it's going to be a good and very tough meeting is when they ask, where you have consensus? And if that question gets asked a lot of the times, that portfolio manager may only want to talk about my out of consensus calls. They don't want to talk about anything that's in consensus. They may not want to talk about any issue where they actually would agree with me. They want to be challenged. They want to talk about opposing viewpoints. And I think that that's just a really strong skill set in an investment manager, because it's so easy to be consensus. If your consensus and performance isn't strong, the excuse can be that you're consensus. So just willing to take opposing viewpoints and be challenged, I think, is a great characteristic in an investment manager.
I think that's great. I want to follow up on the research analyst comment. So the attribute about being curious, I think one thing that's kind of important for directors of research to kind of think about is you almost can't give a research analyst like too much to do where they're just completely booked, because you need to like give them that time to think and to follow their curiosity, because that's a lot of times where the true nuggets come out. So those are good tidbits. Okay, so the next question is, essentially, if you think about it, we are intellectual athletes. And so it's all about how we maintain our energy to make investment decisions. What are some of the things you do to maintain, you know, a high level of energy to make sure you're performing at the highest level possible?
The unhealthy answer would be I drink a lot of coffee, but I do have some healthier traits as well. You know, prior to COVID, I used to be pretty active and pretty athletic. And then there was kind of a roller coaster and phases that came with COVID. But I'm starting to get back into it. And a new activity that I started last month, so I'm now making this public, so I feel like it's going to keep me honest in doing it, is I joined a climbing gym, actually. So rock climbing. It's a new activity for me. It's not something that I'd really ever done before prior to a month ago, but I've really enjoyed it. It's a great stress relief. I really can't get enough of it. Aside from that, yoga and running have always helped me. Those, again, pre-COVID, that's pretty much what I did. And one of my favorite places to run in the DC area is to Teddy Roosevelt Island. I think it's a hidden gem of the DC area. So if anyone's ever in DC, Teddy Roosevelt Island, it's a great place to go. It's a less frequented memorial. So a little bit less of a tourist trap.
So on the rock climbing, your fingers, how long does it take your fingers to adapt? I mean, isn't that the hard part?
They have not. So I will let you know. I will let you know when that happened. The calluses on the first day were not pretty. So,
all right. So before we let you go, how about recommendations? What do you think financial advisors and investors should be thinking about in terms of what they're reading, looking at, or listening to?
So I'll give one podcast recommendation, and it is a policy podcast. So apologies to everyone who does not want any more of that in their lives. But Punchbowl News' morning podcast is the first thing that I listen to in the morning. It's pretty short. Normally, they try to keep it between 12 to 13 minutes. And they just go through three of the top issues going on in Washington. So every day, it's three different issues. And they go a little bit wonky occasionally, but I think that they give some really good inside baseball about the mindsets of policymakers. And they even do a little bit on the investment implications. So I found them really helpful. And I think that it's a good way to start off the morning with politics. If
did you know that one, Robin?
I didn't know that one, and I wrote it down. So there you go.
Yeah, I bet you. Yeah.
Punchbowl? Yeah, it's a good one. I think it's great and cannot recommend it enough. I would say a book recommendation that actually nicely dovetails markets and government would be Frank Partnoy's book, The Match King. It's the story of Ivor Krueger and his company, Krueger & Toll. And I think it's a really fascinating story. It's not a story I was even really familiar with on the company's fraud and bankruptcy, and the catalysts being the Securities Act of 1933 and the subsequent creation of the SEC. So it's a good Ponzi scheme kind of finance thriller that then shows the implications that government can have.
That is a good book. I have read that one, and it is like, why don't we know more
exactly
about this guy?
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a story. Yep.
Great stuff. Well, Courtney, it's been so great to have you on the show today. Thanks for coming on. And how can listeners stay in touch with you and learn more about the latest thinking at Strategus?
Yeah, thank you for having me. For Strategus Asset Management, we do make thought pieces available, try to do them at least once or twice a month. And those can be found on our website, which is strategusasset.com. We do have a new Twitter page as well, which is at Strategus Asset, which is exciting. And then Strategus Securities, so our research arm and the parent company of Strategus Asset Management. We're pretty active on Twitter there as well, which is at Strategus RP. I don't use Twitter for anything besides news following, but I do try to be active on LinkedIn. So welcome to connect with me there.
All right. One last question from me. So this is a question that I know is really, really hot right now. In a month from now, when this is actually published, we're already going to know the answers. But of course, it's March Madness. How far do you have Kentucky going?
Every year, Strategus does a bracket challenge. And every year, I am obligated to have Kentucky winning, because there is actually now a Duke person sitting to my right. And there are several Villanova people at the firm, as well as Georgetown. And there's a couple of Bryant people, too. And they're in the tournament this year. So I have to have Kentucky winning.
No way. I would never have guessed. How could you not do it, right?
I mean, I could save myself some pain if I don't have them winning and put another team in, because I get the joy of them winning or not losing money. But, you know, got to fully lever yourself up.
Exactly.
All right. Well, thank you, Courtney. And that is going to do it for this week. Rusty, take us out with your final words.
Stay balanced and stay the course.
We'll be back soon. Thanks for listening to The Weighing Machine. And thank you for your time and trust in Orion Advisor Solutions.
The Weighing Machine is hosted by Rusty Vanneman, Chief Investment Strategist at Orion Advisor Solutions, and me, Robin Murray, freelance writer and editor. If you have feedback or questions about our podcast today, please send us a note at rusty@orion.com. All opinions expressed by Rusty Vanneman and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and don't reflect the opinion of or endorsement by Orion, its affiliate subsidiaries, and its employees. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for legal, tax, and investment decisions. The opinions are based upon information the participants consider reliable.